Hello, and welcome back to the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast. If this is your first time joining us, I hope you enjoy your stay. I'm your host, Michael. My co-host, Zach, is out on a well-deserved vacation right now. An important part of data science is, as we've discussed many times before, research. Essentially, every data science project involves research of some type, and it's often the vast majority of a data science project. It's not easy to move from confusion and uncertainty to knowledge, but it is important, and it's equally important to share our knowledge of how to carry out that process. That's why this month, we're going to celebrate research by exploring research that members of the Klaviyo data science team have done outside of Klaviyo. As you may have heard in past episodes, the members of our data science team have worked in a variety of areas previous to this job. So stay tuned. No matter who you are, it's likely that you'll learn something you don't already know in the course of this episode. Let's go ahead and start with introductions. All of you have been on the podcast before. Welcome back. I'm going to ask you to give a quick introduction of yourself, the team that you're on, and what you currently do at Klaviyo. Let's go ahead and start off with Tristan.
Sure. Hi there. I'm Tristan. I'm a data scientist, and I work on our DCOM team. So at the moment, various natural language processing projects. My research before coming to Klaviyo was meteor physics at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario.
Very nice. I look forward to hearing more about that. That's an area I know very, very little about. So I know I'm going to be learning something new today. Mike, you're up next.
Yeah, so my name is Mike Galley. I am a data scientist with our KOps Disco team. And essentially what I do is I work as an available data scientist for various groups who need projects and efforts done. Right now I'm working with our sales team to help define equitable portfolios for each of our account executives. My college research was in mechanical engineering, looking at buckling behavior of beams and creating a mechanism to investigate oscillating buckling.
Also an area that I will be honest, I know very little about. I also look forward to learning about that. Annika, welcome back.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Annika Sogsted. I am a data scientist on DCOM with Tristan, and I'm specifically embedded onto the onboarding team. So projects focused on better understanding our users at signup and trying to give them a more personalized onboarding process. And my college research was in the MIT Media Lab, specifically in the human dynamics group. So we were focused on understanding human behavior patterns, spending patterns, travel patterns, and a variety of things like that.
Also something that I've done essentially zero research into. We didn't plan this out beforehand, but I'm very excited that all of these are areas that I get to learn new on. So that's very cool. I think let's go ahead and start off by setting the stage. Where and when, I think you went into this slightly, where and when did you conduct the research that we're focusing on in today's episode? And in a very general sense, what was the research focused on within that area?
My research, like I said, was at the University of Western Ontario, and it was between 2019 and 2021. Specifically, I was looking at millimeter-sized iron meteoroids. So I was trying to find their abundance, how many are around near Earth space, and also trying to figure out their origins.
My research was, dating myself a little bit, back in 2012 at Harvard, and I was looking at a combination of two things. One is structures with negative Poisson's ratio, meaning that the structure, when you applied pressure along certain axes, it compressed on all axes. So, you know, think about if you push down on like a rubber pellet, it expands outward as you push, compress it. Something with a negative Poisson's ratio, instead of, you know, expanding outward as you push it, would actually compress inward. Kind of like, you know, if you think about a soda can or something, when you crush it, it doesn't really go outward. It can crush into itself. Something kind of like that. So that was one aspect. The other aspect, as I mentioned, was oscillating buckling behavior. So part of the negative Poisson's ratio is if you can create a structure that buckles in on itself when you compress it. If you compress it at varying frequencies, you can, you know, get it so that it buckles in a different direction every time it buckles, versus if you compress something, you know, once repeatedly without a frequency per se, it always buckles in the same direction.
And my research was in the, as I said, MIT Media Lab from 2019 to 2022. And I kind of already covered the goal of the human dynamics group. Some of the other projects we did were the Atlas of Opportunity. So looking at demographic and economic information for different geographic regions and forecasting from there to help businesses and governments either decide to put a business somewhere or add some government infrastructure in different places. And the project I'll be talking more about today, though, it was related to consumer spending patterns during COVID.
My guess is an expert in these fields would probably hear those research topics and immediately understand why this research is, like, you know, why this particular subject, why this particular question. And I imagine most of the people listening to this episode are not experts in these fields. And so I think, okay, this is a pretty cool thought, but I have no idea why. So I'd like to ask that question. Why this research question in particular? And I guess just generally, like, if you had to explain to a layman, why did this particular research matter?
When it comes to iron meteoroids, iron is much denser than stone. So if you imagine a pebble and an equally sized hunk of iron and throw them at a spacecraft at tens of kilometers per second, that iron is going to do way more damage. And so we didn't have a very clear idea of how many of these irons are in near Earth space. And so knowing their abundance is very important to threat modeling for spacecraft.
Yeah. So for the oscillating buckling behavior, the importance there is in thinking about locking mechanisms at a micro scale for, you know, thinking like microchips. There's been a lot of attention paid to mechanical operations at a micro scale and how we can utilize those instead of some electrical operations, you know, within transistors, essentially.
For mine, I think COVID was obviously a very unique phenomenon, but it also kind of presents unique opportunity for us to understand how different policy implications and store closures can impact consumer behavior changes, and that can be extended to non-COVID situations.
Yeah. Okay. I feel like I understand kind of the impact of this research a lot more. Obviously, we'll get into the full impact later and the results and all of that, but I think it's important to have that context going in. And I think to start off the questions on kind of the research process itself, I'd like to talk about planning. That's, you know, planning is a key aspect of research. It can often appear invisible when you just read a paper or scan through an abstract, but it's extremely important. So I'd like to ask, what went into planning your research? Did you know the data and the methods that you needed to use up front, or was that something that you actually had to figure out as part of the planning process?
I was very lucky in my research in that it was relatively easy to plan, and it was just the technical details that I needed to sort out along the way. I had good raw data. I even had a bit of process data to start with, and it was just a matter of improving software, reprocessing data, and then doing a sort of full, thorough analysis. So there was sort of some initial planning that went into it, but it wasn't too complicated, thankfully, and it all went relatively well. So not too interesting for me, but I'm sure the rest of you have maybe some more interesting planning stories.
Yeah, so for me, my project was from an engineering perspective. So I was building the mechanism that they were going to be using to essentially generate the data. And because I was building the way that they were going to be generating the data, I had a very clear kind of path forward, which is a little bit different from than typical data science effort in terms of, you know, I knew I had to make something that applied compressions at varying frequencies. And I had to figure out a way to make that consistent across different beam lengths and different beam thicknesses. And, you know, knowing those two things, I was able to design something that kind of met that criteria and construct it. So the planning was pretty straightforward for my research.
For my project, we actually had our spending data because of a different ongoing research project. And then COVID hit, and we were kind of like, hey, there's a lot of interesting questions we can ask with this. So it started out pretty vague, but I think we were able to narrow it down and have a somewhat clear plan forward pretty quickly. So again, pretty straightforward. I was relatively new to like network analysis and some graph methods. So I had to learn a little bit about those methods as we went along.
This is a data science podcast. We should talk about data. What did the data for your research look like? Were there any complications with using it, or I guess in Mike's case, generating it, or, you know, obviously using any other data that was involved in building that mechanism?
Yeah. So one of the things that I had to think about was, so as you're applying compressions to a beam, you know, the beam resists those compressions, and beams of varying thickness are going to resist that at different rates, which made it so that we couldn't reliably dictate the frequency of the compressions because of the feedback loop of the resistance of the beam of those compressions. So essentially, I had to create a way to track the frequency. That way we could tune how fast it was compressing. So, you know, if you think about, you can apply compressions at a frequency, it's resisting, that's going to slow down the compressions no matter kind of like what mechanism you're using. And so you can speed it up to get to the frequency you want. So creating that feedback mechanism so that the data was actually at a frequency that we cared about was really important.
Meteors being part of astronomy, my raw data came from the Canadian Automated Meteor Observatory. But unlike most data in astronomy, it wasn't still images, it was video. So I had 4 years of terabytes upon terabytes of 512 pixel by 512 pixel video data of a little patch of night sky. And really, that was sort of its own complication. The volume of data was just so large. My final processing run took nearly 2 weeks, continuously using nearly 300 computer cores. So it was just a huge mountain of data to sift through.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of data. I was using, like I mentioned, consumer spending data. So we initially had what stores consumers went to and on what day, as well as the location of those stores. It was relatively clean, and we converted it to aggregated daily brand co-visits. So if you visit two stores in the same day, we would consider that a co-visit. And we use that to create our graphs.
Yeah, three very different data setups here, I'm hearing. Let's talk about the methods. I guess, were there any complications with the methods that you were using, either methods that didn't work as you expected, or methods that you needed to learn new to finish the research, or that you needed to explore settings or options you'd never tried before?
Yeah, my project had sort of a little mini project within it, because I alluded to this earlier, I needed to reprocess existing data, but also make sure that all new automated data coming in was improved the way we wanted it to be. But in changing the software, our sensitivity for just raw detection of meteors changed. And so we needed to do a whole parameter search to find what the new best settings were, given the changes in our software. By improving our data, we ended up having, you know, downstream effects. And so that was a little tangent to make sure that everything was still up to quality. And thankfully, in the end, we even increased the quality a little bit, increased our sensitivity. But that was a bit of a complication that came up.
Yeah. So for what I was doing, I had to essentially learn how to machine parts. Again, this is something very different from data science. So it's hard to kind of like fit the project into, you know, relevant learnings and such.
I would categorize working with machine parts as a method. I think this counts.
Yeah. So yeah, no, learning to use a milling machine properly, lathe and all that. Like, it was definitely a fun project to work on. And it was definitely very different than, you know, what I've done since then. So the methods, you know, you're essentially learning how to be a machinist in terms of working with all different types of milling machines. And, you know, you kind of think about the fact, how do people create these weird, intricate pieces of, you know, solid metal? And you do it. So I think the most fun thing I learned during that, you know, process of learning each of the different tools in the machine shop was creating a clamp. So essentially, we had to be able to create a clamp that was had some really tight fits. And so you had to get like almost exactly perfect dimensions on multiple pieces that then had to fit together properly. And that's how you, you know, you passed essentially and were allowed to continue by yourself in the machine shop. So it was a very fun aspect of the learning process.
For me, I think the methods we used were mostly straightforward. Like I mentioned, I did have to do some reading on different network analysis methods. I think one kind of complication that came up as we got further down into our data and we're trying to compare states are people spending across states. So dealing with that, that was kind of more of a data cleaning issue.
Let's talk a little bit about the findings. So I guess in one sentence, what were the results of your research?
One sentence summary, millimeter-sized iron meteors at the slowest speeds are 4 times more abundant than previously thought.
4 times. It's a lot of times.
Yeah.
That feels like it was a missing part of a threat analysis.
Yep. And there are some stories that I will not share on a podcast regarding that.
I can imagine.
Won't or can't?
Not sure.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those where you look back at the missing knowledge of, you know, previous efforts that have gone on, and you're like, how did they get this to work without knowing that? Because you got to figure those ships up in space are getting pelted 4 times more often than was originally thought, which, you know, when you're designing something for space travel, probably is good to know ahead of time.
Yeah, important to know how much shielding to put on it, because that shielding is very expensive too.
Yeah, so one sentence summary of my research was, I would say, designing tools to conduct physical research is not a straightforward or simple process. So,
as someone who has trouble hammering things into the wall, I believe you.
Yeah, as someone going through a move deassembling, I can't even imagine. For me, I guess, so closed states or states with more strict COVID policy closures had dramatically different changes and slower recoveries to pre-pandemic states compared to states with more open or loose COVID policies. And some brands and industries were more robust to COVID than others across states.
All right, I'm going to give you more than one sentence now. So if you need more than one sentence, feel free to take it. What did you find the most interesting about your findings? And I guess, what do you think the audience would find the most interesting as a takeaway?
When it comes to iron meteors or iron meteoroids specifically, they maybe unsurprisingly come from the asteroid belt, but specifically, they are the cores of ancient asteroids. So back when large asteroids in the asteroid belt were forming, they were large enough and molten enough that the iron basically sunk to the center of these objects, kind of similar to how Earth's iron core, iron is very dense, and so it's collected at the center. The asteroids cooled. A long while later, these asteroids collided and burst apart, and these little bits of iron were released. And we also found that the iron meteoroids are very old, as in they've been orbiting the sun for a very long time. So millions upon millions of years have gone by of these little tiny centers of asteroids until they have finally crossed paths with Earth and vaporized in the atmosphere. And I think that's just a fun solar system adventure.
If those are a lot more common than we thought, does that mean that there were more asteroids in ancient space than we thought? Or am I making a logical leap that's not appropriate there?
Not necessarily, just that the cores were large enough and these objects have been sort of shifted out of the asteroid belt enough into near Earth space such that we're able to detect these objects.
How big does one of these iron cores have to be to actually reach Earth's surface versus vaporizing?
It has to be substantially large. I don't have an exact number, but it definitely has to be larger than the centimeter scale. Interestingly, if they're really, really small, like micron size, it is possible, just the physics of the situation, that they don't vaporize and little tiny grains can slow down without vaporizing and fall to the surface.
So the terminal velocity of the really tiny ones is low enough that they don't actually generate the friction to vaporize. Is that a correct understanding?
It's not the terminal velocity, it's that the surface area to mass ratio is such that they're able to decelerate without heating up too much.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say it was necessarily the most interesting, but definitely the most fun aspect of my project was creating something that I then kind of was able to let loose and see it rapidly compress these rubber beans. So, you know, in your head, you can imagine a strand of rubber, essentially, that's 4 to 5 inches long. And you take each end and you lock it in place. And then you compress one side of it and you keep the other one still. Now think about doing that multiple times per second. And, you know, it's compressing an inch or so. So it went really fast and made a lot of noise. And it was really hilarious seeing these, you know, little rubber beans just bouncing back and forth once you got it going up to speed.
Yeah, the context that it's compressing it by like a full inch, that makes it, in my opinion, much funnier.
Yeah, it was essentially, I mean, if you think about, you know, taking your hand and cupping it at a 90 degree angle where your knuckles are, that's about how far the beam would go in each direction. And it'd be doing that multiple times per second. So yeah, it was fun to watch.
That almost sounds frightening. Were you protected, like in case things went wrong?
You know, I built it Ford Tough. It was that thing was sturdy. So the first iteration of it, I actually, you know, put it on a table and started testing it, and then quickly realized that this was not going to work and that I had to bolt it to the table. And we do have, there were research tables where you could bolt things to them. They were, you know, typically for other purposes than just bolting something that's going to go crazy itself. I think they were for shaking. They were like vibration tables or something like that. But it worked out that I could bolt this little thing. So I guess an added piece of context that'll prove helpful is the size of the entire contraption was about a foot by a foot and a half. And so, you know, when I was talking about how fast it's going, it's this little thing just pumping away at this little piece of rubber and going nuts. But once I had it bolted down, it was even more fun because then you were able to see like the full effect. And it was really cool. The resonant frequency, so the resonant buckling frequency, you could see it where, you know, you'd be turning a dial, it'd be, you know, pumping at, let's say, 80 times per minute, and it would always go in the same direction. And then you'd keep turning it slowly and, you know, you hit the right frequency. And, you know, there's a little bit of leeway depending on the integrity of the material itself. So the higher the integrity, the bigger the leeway. You know, if there's a crack in the material, it's always going to want to buckle a certain direction. And so the band gets tighter. But being able to see, like, when you reach a specific number, it starts going back and forth instead of the same direction. And then you just, you know, so like 84 times per minute, it would go back and forth. But 83 times, it would always go in the same direction. So you'd be able to, like, play back and forth between getting it to go back, you know, oscillating versus buckling in the same direction repeatedly. It was definitely a lot of fun.
That's very cool. I wish we like had a video we could attach in the show notes on this, because I imagine that would be very cool to see.
Somewhere in the world, there is a video of this thing. What I don't know is in the, you know, 8 phones I've had since then is if it was stored on the cloud somewhere or not, maybe.
Yeah.
But
if,
now,
if we happen to track it down, then I guess we'll have it in the show notes. If not, then please imagine it at home. It's very funny if you aren't already.
For my project, I think a lot of the kind of surface level findings are pretty much what you'd expect, you know, when states close down, people aren't going to restaurants as much and they're ordering from delivery services. What I think was more interesting was kind of the lasting effects that longer, stricter closures had on consumer spending patterns and the networks recovering. So I remember even it was a year after the pandemic and states had been open for a while. And if you looked at the component size in bars, so how many people are going to bars, it shot up a lot faster and recovered very quickly in states that had shorter closures generally. But in, for example, actually Massachusetts, a year after, it was still below pre-pandemic levels. So I think some changes like that were interesting and just across different industries. So kind of in closed and open states, childcare services were really fast to recover, which I thought was interesting. People want to get their kids back in daycare, I guess.
That's interesting. What was the granularity of like different industries that you had? Just to give us a sense of like the universe of like different types of businesses you were looking at.
Yeah, we were mapping them to the NAICS industry code. So pretty standard, somewhat high level industries. But for example, for food, we had it split out for restaurants or if they were a delivery service.
Very cool. This is a good reminder to people that like at the end of the day, you do research for a reason. Like you're always learning something. You're always seeing something interesting from it. And it's a good reminder that that's, you know, always keep that in mind as you're doing the research, that there is a payoff here. I think I'd like to move to kind of what happened after you had the results, kind of the process of presenting them. So I guess where and how did you present the results of your research? Are there any interesting stories attached to that?
For me, the main form of presentation was just a single academic paper, peer-reviewed. But I was also able to present at 2 conferences. One was the American Astronomical Society in 2021 and also the Meteoroids 2022 conference. Somewhat unfortunately, they were both virtual. And I had the sort of funny timing of everyone I knew in grad school before me had all had conference experiences, in person, that is. And everyone after me had in-person conference experiences. But then me, I was just right at the time where everything was virtual. So that's the most interesting part of my presentation story.
Was it part of like a virtual poster session or was it like you were in a panel with a group of other people?
Yeah, both were in a panel with other people. Basically, I recorded a longer version of the presentation that people would see beforehand. And then in the live session, it was a lightning talk summarizing it along with live questions and also Slack async questions as well, of course.
Yeah, the live questions, I've done a few conferences as well, just from going through grad school. And the live questions are always, I found them the most fun, but also the most stressful part of the experience.
They were definitely always what I was most nervous for, but then looking back on it, it was never bad.
Yeah, because most of the time when people have a question, it's like either they're genuinely curious and they just want a clarification, or they might have an interesting idea that is like a branch off of what you did, and maybe it's something you hadn't thought about before. Like those are oftentimes the best questions.
For sure. And oftentimes at conferences, yes, there are experts in your field, but they aren't necessarily experts in your research. And so they aren't necessarily, you know, defense level questions.
Very true. Obviously, a lot of people who go to these talks are, you know, fellow grad students or fellow people kind of at the intro level of the research, and they're there just to learn as well. So, yeah.
Yeah. So my work was definitely a bit more clear cut without kind of open-ended findings. And so the presentation of it was much more process rather than results. And there was definitely some interesting feedback I got during mine. And, you know, there were decisions I made during the design of the mechanism that could have been done better. So, you know, one important aspect in when you're retroing your project and you're presenting on it is making sure in, you know, the next effort that you do, you kind of identify where you could have done better and not necessarily do better, but enable better processes. So taking time in certain phases of the project, for example, you know, I rushed through certain parts of it that probably should have taken, you know, a few weeks instead of 1 week. And if I had taken a few weeks, maybe I would have seen better designs or came up with better designs that just would have resulted in a better product overall.
And my presentation was at a conference. It was the International Network for Social Network Analysis in 2022. A fun story. Well, it was in Australia, and it was the week before I started at Klaviyo. So that was in itself pretty fun. And I think it was kind of interesting too. Australia had a very different response to COVID, and they kind of responded very quickly and thoroughly to it and then opened up again in a much different way than the United States. So it was interesting presenting my work there and kind of seeing how they thought about it very differently and thinking about just more generally the policy behind that and how like isolated closures would have impacted Australia.
Very cool. Was that also a setting with like a lightning talk or a panel?
Yeah, it was 15-minute presentation followed by open questions.
I guess the same like comment/question about questions. Did you run into any that were especially interesting, or was that a part that you were? I know I'm always somewhat dreading it, but it also ends up being oftentimes the most interesting part.
Yeah, I thought there were a lot of good discussions that came out of the talks and new connections for the group and like different, like the group more broadly for human dynamics of like new questions to ask from the consumer spending data and using the network framework. So yeah, I think there are some pretty interesting questions. Again, Nothing defense level, as Tristan said.
Which is good. I mean, there's a reason that you don't want defense level questions in like a casual 15-minute talk at a conference. I'd like to switch over a little bit. We've gone into a fair amount of detail on the research and for good reason. I think it was like important to do that. But I'd like to switch over and think about the meta level for a bit. So I think it's important to acknowledge the research findings themselves are interesting, but I'd also like to make sure we discuss how it impacted your time at Klaviyo. So I guess the question is, did this research help prepare you for the type of research that you do at Klaviyo now, even if, like Mike's, it's a very different type of research?
Yeah, and I can start with that. I think one of the big things that I learned doing that research was the process of getting multiple perspectives, even if it's, you know, very minimal in terms of the amount of review each perspective is doing. So just, you know, getting a lot of eyes on something, it matters, and it greatly improves process of the research. You know, research doesn't always have meaningful findings, even if it's well done. And that's why I say, you know, I focus on the process, not necessarily the end product. But yeah, it definitely taught me the value of getting multiple perspectives on something early in that process.
That's one that feels very applicable no matter what area you're doing research in, no matter what type of research it is. It's oftentimes getting an outside view on something is one of the most valuable things you can do, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't even have to be a detailed view. It doesn't even have to be a deep dive. It can just be, you know, this small part that you're thinking, getting somebody who has a totally different experience in terms of, you know, what they bring to the table, right? So I have a lot of experience in forecasting, and so I have a time series mentality, and getting that mentality into something like, you know, a generative AI project could be helpful for whoever that is, who, you know, whoever's doing that work, even if it isn't necessarily, you know, I don't have a good perspective kind of on what they're working on as a whole. I might be able to contribute, you know, tidbits that would build up to something better.
One of the skills that I really picked up from my research was how to spin a story. As in, say you have you know, your results, they're quantitative, but they're just numbers. And how do you turn that into something that is not only understandable by people, but specifically interesting? How do you tell a story with it? And I guess specifically is how to make a good plot. There's such an art to creating good graphs and plots and figures. And it's very difficult. And I'm by no means great at it, but I definitely got that sort of initial intuition for what is important to see in a plot. How do you make it as efficient as possible without too much information, but also interesting, just enough information? And I think that's something I've carried over to Klaviyo.
Yeah, I'd agree. That's an incredibly important skill when you work with data, is just being able to visualize that data in an intelligible and interesting way. And the two are, they're different. Sometimes they're even at odds, but they're both extremely important. And I think we've actually had, I think, an entire episode on visualizing data before, but it's an extremely important topic. I am fully planning for us to have another data visualization episode in the future. So I might have to get some of those insights for that.
I think some of the biggest skills that I picked up were kind of relating back to Mike's point of the process behind it and just how frequently that's used here at Klaviyo. So just the ability to take kind of a vague question you have, formulate a more specific research question and a plan to answer that. I think also dealing with situations where we don't have all the data just as we'd want it, or we can't go back in time and collect this data, been working through those situations. So it's a really helpful skill as well.
Not having all of the data that you'd like. I'm sure that's not something that ever comes up in other research you've done.
No, never.
That is, again, I think just a core skill of being a data scientist, is being able to understand when you can and when you can't make up for that, and like ways you have to adapt if you run into trouble with the amount of data that's available. Yeah, definitely. If you work with data and you haven't thought about that, I think this is a good call to action to start thinking about those, problems. I think people have in their minds some notion of what research is and what research looks like. And I think oftentimes those can include misconceptions, especially from people who have not done as much research or people who have not done research of a certain type. So I'd like to ask, in your mind, what is the biggest misconception that people have about the type of research that you did that we talked about during this episode, or I guess the type that you do now, if there's a more salient one there?
So I'll lead, because it is directly tied to what we just said in terms of dealing with missing data. I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that you have the data that you need, you know, going into an effort. And there's kind of an old joke about data science in that 80% of the work is data cleaning. You know, once your data is actually structured, there's so many tools and algorithms out there that you can kind of just easily apply that really it does make the process of figuring out what data you actually have, what gaps you have, what assumptions you need to make based off those gaps, what assumptions you can't make based off those gaps. Yeah, I would say that's the biggest misconception, is just even though we have all of this data, right? We're ever expanding the amount of data we collect, we don't have the data we need necessarily. So,
and in some cases, it's impossible to have the data that you need.
Yeah. For example, you'll never be able to collect, you know, what did somebody say 5,000 years ago, right? There's no way that we can track that. We can say, you know, oh, what somebody wrote and that we have a record of, maybe, but even then you can't confirm what was said. So things like that. Yeah.
My thought is very general. I think people forget that it's okay to not know things. And that's also the point of research, is that there's something you don't know. You have a question or a set of questions, and the whole point is that you're trying to figure it out, either answer it, or if you can't answer it, sort of find a new set of questions that you don't know the answers to and just explore and learn things. And it's okay to not know things.
Yeah, I really like that one. Another thing that I think sometimes comes up is people just assume research is kind of boring and not very creative. But I think there's a lot of opportunities to exercise creativity, whether that's taking results and formatting an interesting plot, like Tristan was talking about, or just in how you're approaching the question. So I think being able to think outside of the box is just super invaluable. And I think a lot of people just assume that research is kind of cut and dry.
Yeah, absolutely not a cut and dry process. I think even if you're applying the same method in one project after another, oftentimes there are distinct peculiarities of the way that you have to use it in each of those settings. So even something as simple as just applying a single method multiple times. I think we're already leaning in this direction. We've gotten some advice in that last question, I think, but as always, I would like to finish off with some practical advice for our listeners. I imagine a lot of people listening to this podcast either are currently working on research or are about to kick off a research project in the near future. And I would ask, what is your top piece of advice for them?
Stay organized. Every step of the way, dedicate a little bit of time to staying organized. Do not let your file structure fall apart. Do not label your report final _2 version 3. Like, just keep it organized. It's worth the effort. It's worth the time. I also want to call out a paper published called Good Enough Practices in Scientific Computing by Wilson et al. 2016. It outlines just the basics of handling data, staying organized, version control as well. And it has great reminders and tips, even if you aren't doing scientific computing.
The final _2 is absolutely calling out my high school self. I remember I was a co-editor of the literary magazine, and we would reach the point in the year where we're trying to get things ready to proof. And, you know, I would be looking at a document and I'd say, like, where are all of the edits we made last week? I'm looking at reflections_final. And my co-editor in chief would say, oh, that's because you should be looking at reflections_done. Not even an _2, just like a synonym. So definitely don't do that.
That's absolutely fantastic. And anyone who's been around for long enough has committed some of those acts for sure. So I think, Tristan, that is a fantastic reminder that we all feel a little, the sting just a little bit too much there. You know, one practical thing, it gets back to something I've already said, but that is to get as many eyes on something as possible. Even people who aren't necessarily, you know, you don't think of them as data scientists or you don't think of them as subject matter experts, everybody has a unique perspective. And each of those unique perspectives could be the one that opens up a brand new door in terms of kind of project planning. You're looking at doing specific algorithms, you're looking at doing the research a specific way, and those come from your, you know, knowledge and background. But there could be an alternative path. And I've experienced it many times professionally where I miss, you know, a really clear and obvious way to do something just because I have, you know, tunnel vision sometimes in terms of trying to get the job done, right? Get the research done, get it out the door. And the way to avoid a lesser end result is to make sure you get those perspectives as early as possible. And that way, when you do kind of get in your tunnel vision mode where you're really pumping through, you've already gotten the input. So that's one thing I would say for sure people should keep in mind is to get those perspectives early and often.
Agreed, 100%.
I think my piece of advice kind of relates back to something that was said earlier about, you know, being okay with the unknown, but similarly kind of being okay with failure or not having significant results. I think if you stay focused on having a good process, the results will come and you will be a little bit less afraid of failure because you'll recognize like failure as a learning. So I think having that mindset into it will kind of keep you motivated and making steps and making progress on the project.
Agreed. I mean, it certainly in some settings cannot feel good to get a null result, but as we call it in statistics, like if the truth is a null result and you say otherwise, that is an error and you want to avoid errors. So I agree 100% with that. I think all of that's fantastic advice. No matter what type of research you're involved in, all of that should apply to what you're doing. Take that to heart. We are reaching the end of our hour. So I want to thank all of the panelists for coming on, talking about research, talking about how to do research. It's been a fantastic conversation. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
And with that, we have reached the end of our episode. Again, I would like to thank our panelists for being on. This episode of the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast, as all episodes of the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast are, was sponsored by Klaviyo. Klaviyo's intelligent marketing automation platform makes it easier for marketers to centralize and use every piece of their customer data to deliver hyper-personalized experiences across all their channels, increasing conversions and revenue. If you want to learn more about Klaviyo, go to klaviyo.com. That's K-L-A-V-I-Y-O.com. If you liked what you heard on this episode, if you learned something from it, then please consider subscribing. You should be able to do that in just about any podcast distribution network wherever you're listening to this episode. Also consider leaving us a rating. Consider rating us 5 stars, giving us a thumbs up, whatever rating system you have, wherever you are listening to this episode. Also, please consider leaving us a review. We take reviews very seriously. We read all of them and we care about all of them. Also, all of those happen to help boost us in the algorithm. You know, we'll be transparent about that. It does help us out, but it also does help people who are interested in content like the content that you've just heard actually come across it in algorithms. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about what you heard on this episode, the best person to contact is me. The best place to reach me is my Twitter account. That's Lawson_M_T, L-A-W-S-O-N underscore M underscore T. Thank you for listening. Have a great month.